Hey, what you're about to listen to is the podcast version of what was a live radio segment on KPFA. Consequently, when you hear us give out a call-in number, you don't want to call it. If you're listening to this as a podcast, it is already too late, and nobody on the other end of that phone number is going to have any useful answers for you. All right, let's go to this week's Corona Calls. We're going to turn, as we do most weeks at this time, to new developments in the world of COVID-19. Our guest is Dr. John Swartzberg, Clinical Professor Emeritus of Infectious Diseases at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Good morning, Dr. Swartzberg.
Good morning.
I want to start with a kind of broader public health question as we continue to assess the fallout from what the Trump administration called its big, beautiful bill. The estimates are that somewhere within between 12 and 17 million people are going to lose their health coverage, principally Medicaid recipients, over the 10-year lifespan of this bill. And it struck me after we spoke last week that this really reverses an almost two-decade trend of kind of slowly, painfully expanding the number of people who have health insurance in this country. I'm curious if there's a conversation happening in public health circles about what this means for the ability to communicate good health information to people who need it, to mount public health responses to things like the COVID pandemic.
Sure. It is, when you say in public health, in the public health community conversations, I would say this is number one on people's minds, because the implications of this are just enormous. First and foremost, of course, it means that millions of people who previously had access to the healthcare system will no longer have that. And that's going to have not only a ripple effect on our entire society, but just think of these individuals and their families and what this is going to mean to their health and to the community's health. So this is paramount in everybody's mind in terms of the implications of this horrific bill. They're beyond empathy for our fellow human beings. I don't think people adequately recognize what this bill is going to mean for the rest of society and for us as individuals. When individuals don't have access to medical care until they're terribly sick, it means they're going to have, amongst many other things, diseases that could easily spread to other people that could have been nipped in the bud. So it just fans the flames of the potential for infectious diseases, my field. But it does a lot more than that in terms of our society. So many hospitals depend upon Medicaid, here in California, Medi-Cal, that without that money that's going to be coming in, it's going to put a tremendous stress upon hospitals, especially those in the rural areas. And predictions are that there are going to be quite a few hospital closings, particularly in rural areas, and ironically, in areas of the country that have a robust MAGA movement. So it's going to have an effect on the entire society. Remember that if somebody doesn't have any insurance and is terribly ill and appears in the emergency room, they have to be taken care of. Not only have to be by law, but more importantly, they have to be just morally have to be cared for, which means that somebody's going to have to pay that bill. And that's going to put, as I was mentioning, an enormous amount of stress on the healthcare system. I could go on and on, Brian, but this is just another in a long line of terrible things that have come out of the Trump administration in the last 6 months.
I've been thinking about what this means for health information, and remember reading during the rollout of COVID vaccinations that one of the most trusted messengers for information about vaccines is a primary healthcare provider. You know, if you're someone who is just by nature a little bit suspicious, you're probably not going to get the vaccine on the basis of like Governor Gavin Newsom doing a press conference. But if you've been seeing a doctor regularly for years and that person like, you know, set a bone when you broke your arm, gave you antibiotics when you had an infection, ordered some scans when you had mysterious symptoms, you're probably going to trust that person when they say this vaccine is good, you should get it so you don't get sick, in a way that you don't have that kind of trusted medical messenger in your life if you're just bouncing in and out of emergency rooms when you're in absolute crisis.
Well, sure, that's right. Study after study over decades has shown that if a patient, a person has a good relationship with their primary care provider, that turns out to be a very powerful way that that individual, the patient, can get not only good, solid medical advice, but they will respond in a positive way to that medical advice and take care of themselves and take care of their community. So this 11 million, 12 million, 14 million people now won't have that. And so it's going to have implications in terms of influenza, RSV, COVID coming up in the fall, in terms of the vaccines. It's going to be more difficult to really get to a lot of people who previously the medical system could work with to address these issues. There's an irony here. What we're going to be seeing with the CDC no longer being an effective communication tool and the government being something that people can't trust, tragically, the medical societies are going to be picking up a lot of the slack that's been left from the loss of credibility of the CDC, for example, and HHS. And we're going to be seeing the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Infectious Disease Society of America, the American College of Physicians, and the list goes on, picking up a lot of this solid information that the CDC no longer is addressing or no longer addressing in a scientific way. And those societies are going to be, we're going to be seeing publications from those societies getting out to the public over the next several months. And so that can't replace what we had as a very effective system previously, but at least it will pick up some of the slack that we've lost with these new policies.
But again, if that information is not being relayed through a trusted health provider, it's just not going to reach some amount of people.
That's right.
Speaking of reaching people, we should go to questions from our audience. The phone number is 1-800-958-9008. If you want to put a COVID question to Dr. John Swartzberg, that's 1-800-958-9008 for your corona calls. We have ample supply of questions in our inbox, Dr. Swartzberg, many of them follow-ups on your discussion of the vacation precautions you took on your most recent trip. Kelly in San Francisco wrote to ask about applying your practices to Kelly's upcoming trip to Greece. First question is, in addition to masking in the airport and dining outdoors, did you also mask in other indoor spaces such as taxis, museums, and shops?
No, we didn't. I was talking about this last week or the week before. We avoided places indoors that were very crowded, but we made this calculus that this is our vacation. We really want to have a good time as possible and try to prevent getting sick along the way. And so we made compromises with that. There was one restaurant we really wanted to go to. It was much too hot to sit outdoors because of the heat wave that was going through Europe at the time. And we sat indoors. So I would say that we weren't perfect, but we did the best we could, trying to balance a good time with wearing a mask.
Second question from Kelly. I am planning to mask on the plane as well as in the airport. I have heard that masks are only effective for a certain number of hours. Should I plan to change my mask after a given amount of time?
Yes, certainly not on the flight, even a long flight, even a 14, 16 hour flight, there's no need for that. But we know that after a number of hours, and the studies have varied on this from 20 to 30 hours to 30 to 40 hours of wearing, for example, an N95, that their efficacy is no longer as good. So what we did was we wore an N95, as Kelly's planning to do, in the airport and on the plane, at least while the plane was on the tarmac. And then we used that mask for one flight, and we brought a separate mask for the flight home. So we had a new mask for that flight. So that's the way we handle that. So it required, instead of one mask for the entire trip, it required two. We also brought some KN95s that we could put on in situations where we would feel more comfortable.
All right, a more technical question in the same vein from a listener who asked to remain anonymous. They write, I took a carbon dioxide monitor on a Boeing 777 from San Francisco to Honolulu. The plane was full. Carbon dioxide readings in the outdoor air in the Berkeley Hills are about 450 parts per million. On the plane, the readings maxed out at 2,806 parts per million. That's when the plane was being loaded. They dropped to between 1,500 and 2,000 parts per million in the middle of the flight. This person goes on to write, I am sure that I have documented higher readings on longer flights, but can't seem to find the photo records. Generally, I was alarmed by the apparent poor air circulation. Have you noted CO2 level monitoring in any of the flight circulation studies? Do you have thoughts on this?
That's a really interesting question. We've been trying to correlate CO2 levels to the risk. And there is a correlation that seems to be fairly consistently showing up. So CO2 monitoring is a surrogate marker for how much air you're rebreathing that other people may be rebreathing as well. So I'm disturbed by what this listener found. Those levels of CO2, they dropped when the plane was in the air for a while, but they didn't drop nearly as much as I would have anticipated, which suggests to me that some of the data that, or some of the ventilation system in that plane may not have been optimal. I guess it comes back, Brian, to the fact that there's no way to guarantee safety. Maybe a strategy that this listener may be suggesting is that if the CO2 monitor continues to be high in the airplane, then keep the mask on in the airplane. That would perhaps be a reasonable strategy that I hadn't entertained previously. So bottom line, at this point, CO2 monitoring, I think there's a lot of science that's been done on this, but there's a lot more that needs to be done before we can reliably use this as a surrogate marker for contamination in the air.
So the question I had going through these numbers is carbon dioxide is the levels give you kind of a proxy for air exchange, how much the air in your space is being diluted with outdoor air. But on a plane, you have kind of a closed system, right? The air is being recirculated, but it's being run through filters. If the filters are trapping the virus, you could have high carbon dioxide levels without having an infectious disease threat.
That's right. And that's where some of the correlates with CO2 levels and risk have broken down. We really would need on this show somebody who has much more expertise than I in this area, because there's now a robust amount of science being developed to address this issue and to look for other surrogate markers as well. But you're right. What we're looking for is how much virus is in the air, not how much CO2 is in the air. And to that extent, the air filtration system may be effective in protecting us from the virus, but certainly leaving the CO2 levels higher.
All right, we've done two from the inbox. Let's take some from the phone lines. Kathy is on the line, waiting patiently in Pacific Grove. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning. Thanks so much for continuing the show. I have a question about immunization information. So it was great to hear that the medical societies are stepping up. But here in California, is there a role for the California Department of Public Health and maybe some of our medical centers at our UCs to play a role in making those recommendations to the California public as well for vaccinations?
I'm really glad you asked that question, Kathy, and I really should have mentioned it earlier. We are very fortunate here in California to have a very solid public health system, and the California Department of Public Health, CDPH, is a very reliable source for information. So I would trust what comes out of the CDPH because I know a lot of the people there, including the director of that, and these are very good people. So we'll get good advice about immunizations and other issues about public health from CDPH. The problem that the public health system in states face is that a lot of the money that they use for operating costs, not only for the state, but for the counties and in some instances city health departments, comes from the federal government, comes from the CDC. When we read about the CDC's budget, it's important to remember that an enormous piece of that CDC budget goes directly to the states to support the state health departments. California's percentage is somewhere between 40 and 50% comes from the federal government. This is clearly going to have an impact if the state health departments don't get all of that or get only a fraction of that. What effect that will have? It won't have an effect on disinformation. I don't worry that we're going to get disinformation from CDPH or from our county health departments. What I worry about is that these health departments are going to be hamstrung in terms of doing a lot of the primary epidemiology in the state in terms of what's happening with COVID and other infectious diseases, as well as so many other things it does. So bottom line to this rambling answer is I would definitely trust what we hear from the CDPH, and we are going to be hearing advice from CDPH and from our county health departments. But they are going to be struggling to maintain a lot of the services that they have in the past because of, again, the horrific decisions being made by HHS.
So a diminished Department of Public Health might be able to say, this vaccine schedule that's been put out by the American Academy of Pediatricians is good. What they might not be able to do is tell you with granular detail what the level of COVID or flu is in your community at the moment, because the monitoring networks or the contract tracing machinery is where you would see some attrition.
That's right.
Okay. Next up is Gus in San Francisco. Good morning, Gus.
Good morning. I was wondering if the doctor could tell me if he has any update on a new formulation due out in the fall. I have heard recently that due to this shakeup by RFK Jr. with the advisory panel, that it is likely there will not be a new formulation. And I am concerned because I'm 8 months past my last booster and had a recent aortic valve replacement, so I'm concerned letting my COVID booster level go any longer if there's no certain new formulation due out in September, October.
Goodness. Dr. Schwartzberg?
Yeah. Thanks, Gus, for that important question. The last meeting of ACIP, the advisory committee to the CDC, did not address COVID, which was just an astounding observation. They did not address what the composition of the vaccines would be in the fall. Whether they're going to address that at all is still a big question mark. ACIP is presumably will be meeting again in August. That said, the formulation for the vaccine, that is what we're going to, what structure of the virus we're going to base the vaccine on to protect people, is very unlikely going to change. And that may not be a problem. The reason why I say that is we've got right now two subvariants of Omicron circulating in B.1, 0.8.1, and XFG. Those are the two prominent ones. And both of these have been shown to, the vaccine has been shown to be give protective immunity against them. So, and we also have the advice from the World Health Organization that came out in the spring that a vaccine based upon the formulation from last year should be protective for this coming fall. So the answer to your question, Gus, is I think we're going to be having a formulation that's the same as we had and as we currently have and we had last fall, and that may be okay. When should you get it? If you want to have maximum protection, given that you're concerned about some health issues, you might be looking at every 6 months for vaccination as opposed to every 12.
Got it. All right, let's try to squeeze in one more caller. Sean is on the line in Sebastopol. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning. Doctor, I'm wondering if there's a place maybe on your website where we can find information on how to look deeper into your recommendations and figure out what to do around COVID and just general health out there.
Well, thanks. Thanks, Sean. I don't have a website, so I unfortunately don't have anything really to post for you. But a really good site that or a really good blog that comes out two or three times a week is called Your Local Epidemiologist by an epidemiologist named Caitlin Jettelina. And I would suggest you can subscribe to that for free on Substack. And she gives very sound advice that, frankly, a lot of the advice that I give out pretty much mirrors. So that would be what I would suggest.
She also is extremely good at writing in very plain English for the benefit of lay people and slogs through the entire proceedings of advisory bodies like the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices to summarize the interesting stuff that comes up, which is often just like data in the staff presentations that is completely ignored by the decision-making body.
That's right. She's a very good communicator.
All right. Good luck with that, Sean. And, you know, not everybody has a website. That's why we're on the radio. I hope you get something useful out of our segments here. Dr. Swartzberg, on that note, we should close out this morning's Corona Calls. Thank you for spending another Monday with us.
You're welcome.
All right, that does it for this week's edition of Corona Calls. If you want to send in a question for next week's, you can email coronacalls@kpfa.org. Or tune in live to Call In Live. Usually we air Monday mornings right after 7:30 news headlines on KPFA 94.1 FM in the Bay Area or kpfa.org anywhere in the world. We put a little bit of extra work into repackaging this live segment as a podcast because it feels like the information is useful to a lot of people. And we ought to make it accessible through as many channels as possible. You can help us get the word out by rating and reviewing it in whatever app you're using to listen. And if you want to pitch in some cash, we wouldn't say no. We always take donations at kpfa.org. I appreciate it if you mentioned Corona Calls when you make your pledge. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert. I hope you have a great week. Stay well. We'll talk to you next time.